It's Wednesday, April 25th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 49 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 55 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and on the mics with me is Mike.
Hello.
Adam.
Hi.
And Chad.
Howdy.
I want to remind you guys that there are many great ways to get a hold of all of us. If you guys have a question, comment, just anything you want to kick our way, that there's all kinds of ways you can do it. You can get to us via the forums at feartheboot.com. All of us have email addresses, which is just our first names at feartheboot.com. So Dan at feartheboot.com, Mike at feartheboot.com, and so forth. Or you can also leave us a voicemail. If you happen to be in your car at work when you're listening to the show and all you have handy is a phone, you can find our phone number by going to dragonslanding.com and looking it up there under the DLI podcast.
Or as an, for sure to have it.
As an alternate, you can also try calling us at 206-339-FEAR and leaving us a voicemail there. All right, quick reminder on Ziggurat-Con. If you guys missed the last episode, there is a gaming convention that the soldiers in Iraq are going to be putting on in Baghdad. Unfortunately, because of where they are, they don't have access to very many gaming books or dice or anything like that. So they have put out a call for help to people to send them in stuff to help them out. So we are putting together these little kits we're going to send down, each one consisting of a bag. And in the bag is going to be enough paper, blank character sheets, dice, pencils, and core rule books to play an entire system. If you're interested in donating to that, you can do so using the Make a Donation button at the top of feartheboot.com. If you have your own podcast, we have a 60-second promo you can use, which we will link off the show notes again. And one thing that I forgot to mention in the last episode is that we are putting a cutoff of May 12th on this. So we need to be sure that we have enough time to actually buy the books, package them up, and mail them down so they get there by June 9th.
You mean take all the money and buy lots of tequila and have a ziggurat party?
Yeah, ziggurat Cinco de Mayo.
If by tequila you mean lottery tickets, you would be correct. But we've got to have this stuff to them by June 9th, and it takes a couple weeks to ship. So please have the anything you're going to donate to us by noon Central Time on May 12th, at which point we're going to cut it off and then go shop. And also, if you have something you want to send by postal mail, instead of making a PayPal donation, just send me an email, dan@feartheboot.com, or a private message on the forum, and I will give you a mailing address you can use. Now, Chad?
Yes, sir.
You and I have some makeup to do.
Oh, yeah?
Because in the last episode, we were going around the table talking about what our favorite games are.
Oh, yeah.
And on our forum, a guy by the name of Bottled Violence made a point that I can't argue with. What he said is that it may be fair game for us to mention games that we either have written or are writing, but ultimately it doesn't help the people at home because they can't turn around, look on the shelf behind them and get any kind of insight into what our tastes are. So, Adam gave All Flesh Must Be Eaten. Mike gave
World of Darkness.
World of Darkness.
Yeah.
John gave D&D 3.0. So all these are store-bought games, but Chad and I gave home-written games.
You mean Wiener cop-out answers?
And
yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
In my case specifically, at least we put something out there for Saw. We have never put anything out there for the space opera game. So Chad, we have to go back and give a new answer. Favorite store-bought game.
You know, mine is going to be a little weird. It is going to be, it had two names. One of them was Nightbreed, and I think the other name for it was Nightspawn.
Right.
Is that correct?
Ooh, yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Vomit-tastic.
Yeah, the actual rules for it, I think it was like a Palladium system or something like that. And so the rules were just awful. I mean, they had all that mega damage stuff, and the setting was not even that great either. I just like the concept behind it, is that you were a human being, and you could turn into a monster. Not just sort of the romantic monster like Mike's World of Darkness, but a monstrosity. I mean, you could have tentacles for arms and big fangs and bat wings and all kind of crazy stuff.
You're not necessarily a romantic monster in World of Darkness.
Of course not.
All of us are LARPers.
Sure thing, angst master.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just don't understand you, Mike.
Yeah, because
if
I'm emo.
Cut myself, you'll understand.
yeah, that's me.
We were making, it was kind of a cheesy game. We were making characters for it, and they had these big charts and stuff that you could like roll on to see, okay, this is the arms chart. Okay, you've got tentacles for arms or big crab claws or something crazy like that. And I don't know, I just really liked it. And you can kind of like switch back and forth between being a human and being these things, sort of like a, you can, like a werewolf flips back right. and forth and stuff.
You can switch at will?
Yeah, I think so. It's been a long
this
time.
This totally sounds like a game that you would absolutely hate.
Yeah, it sounds kind of cheesy. And apparently the world is filled with these people, and they have like underground railroads and speakeasies, and that like what the fluff story in the beginning of it.
All right, let me ask the probably the most important question: was there a table for Beard?
No, there was no Beard table.
I can't get into this game. I can't relate with any of the characters. The backstory all rubs me the wrong way.
The reason I like this game, though, is because we changed it. I mean, we instead of there being hundreds of thousands of monsters in every major city across the land, and it this thing being so big but so secret, there's no way the secret could ever be kept. We changed it to where this was like an ultra rare thing, and we kind of added some cults into it, and we made it a little bit darker.
Everything gets better with cults.
I agree.
And beards.
Maybe we added a beard or two.
We also did some other little tweaks to it. Mm-hmm. Like we had the attributes of your creature, because like Chad's saying, you could roll the monster entirely randomly if you wanted to. You didn't have to, but you could roll randomly.
Pick and choose off the chart
and
a la carte.
We started using those things to represent character traits.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's say, for example, if you had like a rattle tail, like a rattlesnake, like you had like a snake's tail with rattles on it, then we would say, okay, this means that you're a somewhat nervous person who's very aware of his surroundings. And I don't remember all of them.
If you had like scales all over yourself or armor plates like a crab or something, then that means that you were... It didn't even have to be necessarily a negative trait. It could also be like, you know, you believe in protection and that sort of thing. Or you're very enclosed and you're very an internal type of person. And yeah, it represented some aspect of your psyche in different ways. And then the more you had, the more, I guess, crazy you were too. But... I guess my answer is still a cop-out answer because we did so many changes to this game of Nightspawn/Nightbreed that...
Nightbane.
Nightbane or whatever Nightbreed. It was called. It was based on a movie.
Yeah, it was. I've seen the movie.
And the movie was... It was a cheesy B direct-to-video movie, but the story of the movie was better than the game itself that it ripped off.
I am surprised, though. I mean, even if there's a massive evolution of the product involved here, that someone on this show picked a Palladium game as their number one choice.
Oh, we never used the rules or anything.
I think it would be better if it was Nightbreed.
We still made fun of the art.
It was Nightbreed. Nightspawn was the original name, and then Todd McFarlane or whoever published Todd McFarlane's comics apparently sued Palladium.
Yeah, because it has Spawn in the name.
It has Spawn in the name, yeah.
He's going to sue Trout next. So.
Well, we're going the direction of, I think, a game about breeding at nighttime sounds more complicated and interesting, but...
Well, there's multiple definitions for the word breed, you know.
I suppose that's true.
Damn, what do you have?
You know, this is going to be fairly predictable, but if I had to go with an off-the-shelf game, my number one choice would be BattleTech.
Oh, I'm stunned.
We had this
big conversation last game about how... we had all these favorite games, yet none of them were BattleTech, and the whole reason that was, and it explained BattleTech in our lives, and now you choose BattleTech, and you just throw the whole last episode out the door. Thank you.
Well, we still go to pick a game we're going to play, of course, we're going to keep the homebrews in the pot as selectable options. Mm-hmm. So everything we said last recording is still true. Now, what I would say...
Here comes the justifications.
We said when we did this, no cheap cop-outs of like ranking several things at the top. I can definitely say, depending on my mood, there are other games that I would pick as my number one.
We said no cheap cop-offs, but I can definitely produce a cheap cop-off if necessary.
So, if I look back across the history of my gaming career, the one game that always keeps floating back to the top of the products out on a shelf of a store, at least have been on the shelf of a store at some point in the past, would be BattleTech. Let's do something a little bit different for Fear the Boot and actually kind of talk at least a little bit peripherally about something in the industry news.
What industry?
There's an industry out there?
There is an industry out there.
Are they FTB compliant?
No, they are typically not.
Oh, I am not interested.
Yes, well, you should be, because if the industry was FTB 9000 compliant, we'd have nothing to say on these podcasts.
Well, our podcast would just basically be nothing but industry news and us talking about how wonderful all the game systems are.
That's true. So the industry news we're going to talk about is Dragon and Dungeon Magazine shutting down.
What is Dragon and Dungeon Magazine?
Dungeon Magazine is actually, in a way, not bad. They had like little sample plot lines and little games you could run in it and stuff.
Yeah, it's a magazine about like modules and stuff for D&D.
It's not bad because it gives you, it's a good idea. Well, it's a good way to get ideas for games. So I actually kind of liked the magazine, and you know, a decade ago, I picked up a few copies for some ideas.
Loosely speaking, Dragon and Dungeon are both long-running magazines, which are currently being published by a company called Paizo, I believe is how it's pronounced. And Dungeon is an adventure module magazine, whereas Dragon, from what I've seen of it, is more of a general setting type magazine. They talk about rules and
Dungeons
magical
and Dragons.
Items. Yeah. It's Dungeons and Dragons magazine. And they split the setting in
it's
half.
It's not exactly fair and balanced.
No. So. Well, there was a time when I believe Dragon actually covered many RPGs. And at some point,
I never had a subscription to either.
At before some point, WotC came in.
And, yeah, and cut that out and made them.
I don't think that's true, but maybe it
does. No, I know for a fact that is true. That because several people have commented on this to me.
Booyah.
Yeah.
So well, there we go. Several
well,
people
that proves
said it.
It.
Yeah. That proves it. Several people told me.
Hey, look it up on Wikipedia. See if it's true.
So I read these threads on the forum, and now listening to this, I got to tell you guys, I don't care.
I don't really care myself for the internal fact of I never had a subscription in the first place, but two, print is dead. Well, magazines and stuff.
Well, let's talk about that. People caring. Let's begin there. I cannot tell you, since this is broken, how many people that I've talked to, and even including one or two on our forum, that have said to me, oh, I can't believe that it's gone. This has been such a fixture of gaming. I mean, I believe Dragon Dungeon, one of them goes back 30 years.
They bumped that number up to 8 to 10 on the forum.
It's, you know, oh, it's been around forever. Now that it's gone, gaming will just never be the same. And it's great for this. It's great for that. And I say, did you have a subscription?
No.
No. And it's like, you know, I see this with a lot of things, gaming included, where there's something in the world that everyone considers as...
There's more nostalgic than actual use.
It's not
function.
It's immovable fixture of life that no one wants to see change. No one wants to see go away. Nobody can bear to live without. But nobody actually takes out their wallet and buys.
Yeah. And I certainly don't. I'm generally not a nostalgic person. So.
I mean... the face of gaming is going to change because this magazine ends. You know what? Probably the third time I've heard about this magazine was this, in fact, this event.
Yeah.
Dragon Magazine is closing down. And that's, okay.
That's not to say that Dragon Magazine doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, you know, a lot of people read it. A lot of people had subscription to it. But
and my background with it, I've personally never had a subscription, mostly just because... growing up, my parents were not the pro RPG type, so getting a subscription to Dragon was about like asking for a subscription to Penthouse.
Well, I mean, even if you had it, though, I mean, who impacts your gaming experience more? The people you sit down with every week for 4 hours around a gaming table, or some writers in California?
Keep in mind, though, part of the context of Dragon, to wrap up my thought, despite the fact that I never had a subscription, I have associated with a lot of people did have subscriptions. So issues of Dragon have been in my hand more than once going throughout my gaming life. But you got to keep in mind that part of the background of this is there was a day when the internet didn't exist in its current form.
You say?
Well, and for that,
you all you had was your local gaming buddies, maybe a gaming shop you talked to people through, but the only way you had of connecting with that role-playing industry and the role-playing market as a whole was through magazines like this. And
that's true of a lot of things, like computers back in the day. I mean, like in the mid-70s and stuff in the early 80s, when you wanted to build you were a computer hobbyist. You wanted to build a computer, you got computer magazines. You ordered the parts through mail order through the magazines and
built a whole separate room in your house to build.
You actually had a workshop for computers and such. And when the internet came along, I mean, when was the last time one of you guys opened up a magazine? about computers. You know, you look all that stuff
waiting
up online.
In the office of a doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
because they don't have Wi-Fi for my laptop.
I was heating up a bagel today at work, and I work in an IT department, and we have mailboxes in the kitchen area, and all these mailboxes are jam packed with computer magazines that all these other IT guys get and never read. And while I was heating up my bagel, I was flipping through one. Because all this stuff is online. And that's what I think is going to happen with Dragon Magazine, or at least the content that it provided and the community that it provided. I think that WotC has taken the next logical and good step of unloading that all to online.
Well, and you can already find, you know, good game ideas like from Dungeon Magazine online. Heck, on our forums, iTyrant just put up recently in the past couple of days a great campaign that he ran, and he has kind of the bullet points of the campaign on our forums. But you can go online and find a whole bunch of different campaign ideas and stuff. So really, why pay for a subscription?
Well, I agree, and I disagree with you guys. I mean, the magazine makes me read the entire article, but when I read internet articles, I skim.
Yeah.
I mean, it's statistics. Well, but you read the first sentence of every paragraph and move on.
I think that's good and bad because, say, Dragon Magazine or Dungeon Magazine, I'm looking for a particular campaign about Ravenloft and vampires. Well, I do a search for it on the site, and it brings up all the stuff that I want, and none of it I don't if the search engine's any good. And there you go. Instead of having... I have a shelf with 350 copies of unsearchable Dragon magazines that is a fire hazard and could fall on me and kill me one day.
Let me play devil's advocate, though. You can't search for something you don't know the name of or you don't know you want.
Yeah, but you know what? The same thing applies for 350 copies of Dragon magazine.
I got to cut the difference here because obviously I'm going to have a little bit of a bias because being part of the whole new media thing,
a very Web 2.0 view. You know,
obviously, well, I mean, we sit here doing a podcast. Obviously, well, the other three of us,
bastards.
Obviously, you know, I mean, I am very in favor of the idea of content that's made by the individual, delivered for free, widely available, customized, you know, et cetera, all those great buzzwords and watchword we get stuff in there.
WotC's a corporation.
And I completely agree with Chad about also, you know, I like the idea of having stuff online because it's portable, because it's small, because you can drill down into it. But at the same time, I have to agree with Adam because while I like all the electronic stuff, I mean, I'm part of that. This is what I do both for a living and for a hobby as a programmer day job and doing this in the, you know, weekends and evenings. Yet, if you look around my room, this room we're sitting in right here, you will see many RPG books. I got much love for the guys that do the PDF stuff.
Yeah.
You know, much love. They put out some great products. They're good people. I mean,
and they
High
can
Moon
do
and
it.
Swords Edge and all those kind of guys are great friends of the show.
You know what? They can do it, and they can have the dream of producing their own role-playing game system and selling it and making at least some coin off of it. Without going to a bank and taking out a loan or a mortgage on
but
their house.
Here's the point. Do you know how many gaming PDFs I own? And I'm not talking about the ones where somebody scanned a print book and ripped it off. I mean, real legitimate, honest PDF books.
I own as many gaming PDFs as I do copies of Dragon Magazine, which is none.
Yeah, and see, and that's kind of the same thing. Now, of course, there's many ways you could take this. For one, I could turn this back on myself and say, you know, well, I love these books. I love the idea of having something I can hold in my hand and page through. And in that sense, I don't think an online site will ever replace a magazine. But then again, how many new role-playing books are there in my collection?
Yeah.
And I could turn right back on myself the same kind of point that I was making to other people that you say you love Dragon, yet how many of you actually had a subscription to it?
Ooh, pointing the finger
That's
at the
right.
man. The next logical step, the next logical question, at any rate, say, we'll use TSR as the, or Wizards of the Coast as the example with D&D. D&D 4.0 is coming out. How much of that book is going to be in a book, which I think that there will be a book and you'll be able to get and stuff. How much of the resources in the book are going to be online? I think that I'm not necessarily saying they're moving to a fully online model, but I think that there's going to be a lot of stuff online. I think that there's going to be a web aspect to it. And I have absolutely nothing to base this on.
I think they'd be stupid not to.
Yeah.
There isn't media out there that's...
to put a little bit of a monkey wrench in this whole conversation, I was listening to an interview with one of the guys from Paizo Publishing.
Going to Papyrus, aren't they?
They are. they're going to go to Wax Etchings. But I was listening to him over on the Pulp Gamer podcast. The guy that heads up the magazine swears up and down that they, despite being a magazine in the information age, were profitable, mm-hmm. and their subscriptions were going up, not down.
Yeah.
I've heard that too.
I've heard that Dragon Magazine was profitable.
Supposedly, Wizards of the Coast pulled the rug out from under them, not because the product was failing, not because this whole thing was broken, but because they've just decided to do something completely and radically different with it.
Mm. Yeah.
You mean they want to sell more D&D 4.0? I mean, Mage Knight? I mean, no. Sorry.
Oh.
Let's go to that, because you guys have mentioned this a couple times now about D&D going to 4.0. I haven't heard that. Where are you guys hearing that?
You think it's not going to go to 4.0?
Oh, I'm sure it will, but what makes you think it's coming down the pipe soon?
There's been back and forth on it. It's every so often a rumor pops up that says about to break it.
Yeah, if you want me to cite you a credible source, I can't.
Yeah,
okay. But if you were to go out to the forums and actually read it, it's coming.
I see. So at this point, it's rumor milled. WotC hasn't released anything.
I think that there's a definite buzz out there about 4.0. And you know what? This is Fear the Boot. We have our hand on the pulse of the gaming industry.
Exactly.
So there could be an official WotC announcement, and this product, 4.0, is dropping Monday, and none of us would have any clue.
You're talking to three people who don't keep an eye on the industry regularly, and we're all three of us getting the same indication that 4.0 is coming. And it's going to be Mage Knight.
And of course, I just pointed a major finger at myself and what a great job I'm doing keeping us updated. Yay, Mike.
Fantastic.
Jerk.
Got an email from a guy by the name of Chris Miles.
Hi, Chris. Friends.
Yeah, Chris and his whole gaming group. And they had a question for us. They said that Fear the Boot has been a big help to them, which I appreciate hearing.
Is it Superman versus Batman?
No.
Because we know the answer to that.
We'll talk about that later.
Well, we're looking for topics that will take up a significant period of time. We have an hour to fill. I mean, a podcast that consists of Batman, and that's it.
Dude,
I'd
subscribe to that podcast.
Like a second and a half. I mean, it's just
somebody with a
one
deep
75-year-old cigar-smoking man who gets on Batman.
James Earl Jones just says Batman.
It's my weekly dose of James Earl Jones' Batman.
Well, last week we talked about who made the best Batman. Who made the best Alfred?
Let's move on.
Okay. Yeah, we'll maybe come back to that in episode 400 million.
Episode plus one.
Mm-hmm. Right. Anyway, and what Chris was saying is that we've been a big help to his games, which, like I said, I'm glad to hear. But he had a question for us. We have talked a lot about how you can use NPCs in various ways to influence your group or to influence your plot. But he said that one of the issues he has is, how do you build an affinity between your group and an NPC? Okay. So you come up with this great idea for an NPC. You come up with this great way the NPC can influence the plot or the party. But how do you actually get the party to care enough about this person to keep coming back to him or her, or to, you know, just in those moments where they're deciding what to do, they might say things like, hey, we should involve so-and-so, or talk to so-and-so, or wouldn't it be great if so-and-so was here?
How much a party loves an NPC is directly proportional to the size of the NPC's beard.
Agree. I mean, I think that perfectly sums up that entire point. Let's move on to how to hate an NPC.
Some of the things that I found that help is, first of all, you have to make an NPC that is easy for the party to distinguish and remember.
Right.
That if you have an NPC that is so deeply nuanced that beneath the surface they have this great character.
The quiet kid who sits in the back of the room thinking really deep thoughts but never expressing himself. Great character that should be played by a PC.
Right.
Horrible NPC.
Have something that is real easy for the group to remember.
I think that's pretty good generic advice, both hate and love the NPC.
Mm-hmm. One of the bits of advice that I have given over the years, people to ask me about NPCs, even before Fear the Boot ever existed, is try and take a social archetype and mess with it just a little bit.
Even a social stereotype.
Like, for example, you have the grumpy civil servant But give him one little twist, just so he's not the generic grumpy civil servant.
Give him the, like, the grumpy civil servant who has a twitch. And when you, and even if you're players and you don't get up and act things out, what? Because my group with Adam definitely did not act things out, especially with Adam. But I came from a group that did. And we did kind of stand up and we used voice and all that sort of stuff. And so there's...
Chad's a LARPer.
I have LARPed before.
You know what? I blindly turned my eye to that.
So, you know, we're sitting around and nobody's acting out. Well, and I look at the player and I'm playing this grumpy civil servant. I give him an eye tick or a twitch and I start using his voice and I start being real ornery with him and stuff. And then I make my face do his little eye twitch and stuff. Well, that makes him memorable. And you could make him a jerk or you could make him a nice guy and stuff. And you, the whole point is to do something to get that NPC to stick into the player's mind.
You also have to, I would say, along these lines, show that the NPC is important to you. Mm-hmm. That if your characters, if your party walks into a room and you say, there's an old woman sitting there, they're not going to pay her much heed. But if you take the time to actually describe her and this woman comes shuffling up and gets in their face and starts saying things to them, suddenly now they're being forced to pay attention to her. And whether she's a big plot device or not, you've at least made it clear that she is important to you in terms of setting the tone and setting the pacing of the story.
And remember, as game master, you control time. And what I mean by that is you have a whole bunch of rambunctious players. You know, most gaming groups are pretty rambunctious. And, you know, you have your old woman situation. So the players burst into the room and there's the old woman. And you're like, this old woman is sitting there. And then you suddenly have, I search the room and I, you know, kick over the chair and I get out my guns and I start loading my guns because I love guns. And then you have people doing this and doing that and making calls, and putting together the plan and playing the game. You say, stop. Everybody stop. And then you take as much time as you as the game master feel appropriate to lay it on thick about who this woman is and what she is doing.
So far we've given two pieces of advice about building affinity between your group and your NPCs, one of which is to make them memorable enough that your party will actually walk away with something about them. The second is to also make them visible and to show that they're important to you by taking the time to describe them. Something else I'd throw in is the party's still not paying attention, make the NPC important.
Right.
And I think there's a very, very difficult line here because if you make the NPC too important, they become frustrating. Yeah. Like, for example, if you have fights and only this one big badass NPC can win the fights, it's irritating.
You mean Chad's quote on the forum where... Go ahead.
Oh, I can't remember that quote.
It's where nothing spices up an adventure like an NPC who's doing all sorts of cool things while the player characters sit around and watch.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. And or if you've got puzzles that only this guy can solve or doors that only he can unlock, this is just frustrating.
To me, that is rule number one. When you get past all of the power gaming stuff and the endless combat and into like actual character development and plot and story, that is rule number one. What you should not do as a game master.
Something else I think that you need to keep in mind is that as a GM playing NPCs, you can fall into a lot of the same ruts as player characters can with, players can with their characters. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a hard ass player, you might end up having a lot of hard ass NPCs. If you have players that tend to be, you know, the stealth ninjas, or if they tend to have particular personality traits, oftentimes also, of course, the players project their own personality traits onto their characters. These are all ruts that I think it's very easy as a GM to fall into with your NPCs as well. And it's important to make your NPCs all different.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
For example, Dan ran a Forgotten Realms game for me and another of our friends. And the town was, you called it Stonekeep or whatever in Forgotten Realms. And in the town, there were several NPCs that really stood out, were very different. They all had their little quirks, but each of them had their own little perspective on life. They each had their own little role in the game and in the town. They all had kind of their own little flavor, but they were all memorable. They were all interesting, and it made the game a lot more enjoyable and a lot more rich.
Yeah, like just one example comes to mind from that game is the temple that was in this little town was for the goddess of luck. And that as they walked into the town, if they ever came back from anywhere, and I didn't do this all the time, but just enough to kind of amuse them, this guy would walk up to him, this priest from the Goddess of Luck and like make them draw a card from a stack. And then he'd look at it, and based on that, he'd just have some passing comment and walk away. But then when plot occurred in the town, he would show back up again. And, you know, he had his own little quirks and such things that made him endearing to the party.
The same game for our group. It was one of those things where you know it was a good NPC because everybody wanted to strangle him. But none of the players could do it, could justify it or would do it or would be, you know, predisposed to actually kill this guy. But all the actual people who are running the characters were like, oh my God, this guy's driving me insane.
You know, I think actually therein lies the single most important piece of advice we can give on this topic.
Drive your players nuts?
No, because I've had NPCs.
That's what my single piece of advice
is. Well, I think that's, I mean, yeah, that works, but I think that's also kind of a one track because right. I've had NPCs that did not drive the party nuts, that were helpful and positive and, you know, that nonetheless the group came to like.
Siva,
yeah, which is this old, crazy, divining lady from one of my games who was very helpful, very positive, very nice, was not there to irritate anyone, and the group kind of came to like her. But what I would say is the most important piece of advice is know your group. And by your group, I don't mean your characters. I mean your players.
Yeah.
You've got to know the kinds of things that get under their skin in a positive or negative way. If, for example, you're playing in a group where someone in the group has a very powerful mothering or fathering instinct, throw in an NPC that's an orphaned little girl who's wandering around helpless.
You know, this advice you're giving, it's really good because it does not just apply to NPCs. It applies to games as well. The single best way you can get your game, your overall game, story, plot, the campaign to succeed is that you, as a game master, get the people who are running the characters to care.
Right.
To actually give a damn.
And you do that by playing on their strengths and their weaknesses.
Yeah,
just like that.
You get to know them socially and what they like and what they want and what they don't want, what they hate. And the same thing applies for NPCs. You get them to give a damn about the NPCs you want them to care about. To actually get them, not their characters to care, because their characters are going to jump through whatever hoops to play the game. You want them as people to care.
And even though we advocate for playing characters, staying in character and making your character separate from you, the fact of the matter is you're still seeing the character through your own eyes and appealing to the player's, you know, personality and everything is absolutely an important part of GMing.
I don't agree with that 100%. I see where you're coming from. And I do agree with it a little. But I think that every character a person makes is a smaller facet of them.
What I'm saying, though, is like if Chad really has this big thing he cares about, trying to make some element in the game play off that maybe a little bit would tie more emotional buy-in into the game.
Yeah.
I'm saying use what you know about your players to draw them more into the game.
But you can also
do that with the NPCs.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, we like to talk about the difference between a character and a player. But in truth, there really isn't one.
Right.
I mean, there should be. That's the point of a role-playing game.
If you play somebody that is so disconnected from who you are and what you are, then, well, you're disconnected. You're not going to have any connection with that player.
I always call it my hook. I always have a part of my character that is part of me, and it changes from character to character. Right. But like some big personality trait of mine, I put in each character. You know, it's
so
different one each time.
So do I.
That way I have my hook. I can relate to the character now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So all of your characters are very emo and angsty, and
because that's me, absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
And all of Adam's characters are into furries, and they wear their little cat ears and tails.
Hey, man, fetish is a big part of all my characters.
Going back to talk about making these characters important, because like I was saying earlier, you don't want to make them too important, but sometimes giving them little bits of information or resources or whatever that the party might need will keep them coming back. You can also create that kind of importance up front. And you can't do this, obviously, for every NPC, nor is this appropriate in every game. But if you've got a small gaming group or within your circle of characters, there's something obvious they're missing. That's a great opportunity for an NPC.
Right.
Yeah. That if you've got two or three players and they're playing an adventuring company and there's no cleric, this is a great opportunity for you to create an NPC. And assuming the NPC is a basically decent person and is memorable and quirky and actually appeals to the things that interest the players and all the things we've talked about, this guy's probably going to end up in the party.
Yep. And you know what's really cool, too, as an extension of that, is when you get to a point to where you trust the players and the players trust you within the game, and they're really interested in certain NPCs, I have found in my games that the players come to me and ask me, do you mind if I play this guy? And because the hooks that you've given them on the couple of NPCs, they take and they start thinking about, and they have developed this NPC in their mind more than what you have done. And there's been cases where I have let my players just totally take over my NPCs, either on a temporary scale to help me out or on a permanent basis where they develop the NPC in their mind to be more interesting than their own original player.
One last piece of advice on building affinity with your NPCs, and this one goes towards a negative affinity, not a positive affinity, and this kind of falls in with know your players. Don't push it too far. That if you're trying to create an NPC that you want to stick around, that you want the party to kind of have this hate affair with, don't push it too far. Because if this guy is just, a complete jerk and ruins everything and does everything wrong, there comes a point.
Well, he transcends NPC into bad guy.
Well, even before that, there comes a point where your group is probably so frustrated by this guy, or will just outright kill the person, that unless that was your intended ending for this relationship, you've probably pushed it too far. So if you're trying to create an NPC that you want to stick around, that you don't necessarily want the players to like, maybe even you want them to actively love to hate, you just got to be careful to know your players and read them well enough to know you've pushed them too far.
I think that you can strike an interesting balance. It takes a lot of practice, and you really have to know your players and be able to think on your feet. But do all NPCs have to either be loved, ignored, or hated by the group?
Right.
Can you have some NPCs that are in the middle where it's a gray area, where the party doesn't like the guy, but they need him, or they like the guy, but they think he's going to stab him in the back, or they don't know what to think about this guy. They don't know his motives on why he's doing certain things, and they have a lot of conjecture. In my games, I like to play a lot of gray area. I like to smudge.
That makes it a lot more interesting in most cases.
I dislike, ultimate good, and I dislike ultimate evil. I don't think it really has a place in a lot of stories and games for my interest.
So, Chris, not knowing your gaming group, it's hard to ask a super specific advice, but I hope that's been at least a little bit of help to you. So good luck to you guys and your gaming group.
Gaming groups? He's spun off into three groups.
Really?
Yeah. So in his letter, he said that he started a club, a role-playing game club in his school.
That's right.
Yeah. And he spun off into three groups. He's one of three.
Powerful international organization.
He is.
All right. Today's other advice topic, that was actually, I guess, a banner topic. So the main advice topic for today, continuing our genre series, is we are going to do the kind of logical sequel topic to Westerns and talk about steampunk.
Why is steampunk so closely related to Westerns?
I've never gotten that either.
That's a good question. Before we get to that, let's do two things real quick. One is to define steampunk, but even before we do that, I want to give a clarification on this series. As we do the series, we are not necessarily trying to talk about how to apply these ideas to a specific game. We are just talking about the genre
whole. Last week's episode wasn't about Deadlands?
No, last week's episode was not.
If it was going to be about a specific game, we would not have used Deadlands last week, because Deadlands is really steampunk. It's not.
Oh, so this week's episode is about Deadlands.
Even beyond that, Deadlands is Western and horror and fantasy, right, and steampunk.
That right there is a good point in of itself, that sometimes you can't boil a game down to a genre. Right. That, like, I could take D&D and I could run D&D as horror. I could run D&D as fantasy.
Whereas Rifts is just horror all the time.
So we are talking about how to run genres, and I guess it would really be best to say that when we talk about running a game, we are talking about a game session, not a game system.
Yeah. So the basic idea is that, like, say you run Deadlands, which is horror and steampunk and fantasy and all, and Western, that you can take a little bit from each of these sections and apply it all to your Deadlands game.
All right, so what is steampunk? Are we defining steampunk? The definition that I think we came up with for it is a setting that lacks technology, yet somehow industrial technology Industrial level technology does things it shouldn't be able to.
In my definition of it, it is something where there is all sorts of technology, but it is missing two things. It is missing electronics, the transistor and such, and it is missing industry. My idea of steampunk, and there's different flavors of it too, is that you have this really complex steam or magic or whatever powered machinery that is all handmade. Whereas we would look at it and say, well, that rolled off an assembly line. There are no assembly lines. And so everything is unique and everything is very intricate and handmade. So it's all about craftsmanship and such.
We don't even have a shared definition because in my
mind. No, we don't.
We need to come up with one definition.
Even like in the game Shining Force back in the day, this is a little retro for some of you youngins, Adam. Like there was this guy named Gorp.
What the hell is Shining Force?
It's a video game. Oh, come on. Everybody knows Shining
Tell
Force.
Tell us a story, Grandpa. Come on. Spin us a yarn.
Grandpa, get off Michael my lawn. Here, ripe old age of 29. Anyway, there was this guy in this fantasy role-playing, well, not really, kind of adventure game sort of deal. Mm-hmm. And he, this mad scientist little character like a gnome or something, I don't even remember, but he made some sort of like little powered armor sort of deal that ran on steam or whatever. To me, that's a touch of steampunk.
Well, see, but that does fit the. I think actually
steam powered technology.
Well, I think we're nitpicking terms here, but actually, it sounds like between the three of us, we have given the same definition that you have some kind of industrial level technology that is out of place and doing things industrial technology should not be capable of.
Right,
and that's what Chad's like. Chad mentioned that with the missing of the transistor. You're talking about a fantasy setting where somebody's building steam powered armor.
Right,
I mean. Well, it's, you
clockwork, steam-powered clockwork robots.
Yeah. Arcanum is, I mean, loaded with
so
it.
So I think really our definition is the same. We're just choosing to
describe
it using different terms. Now, Chad raised, or I think it was Chad who raised a good question as to why is it always associated with Westerns?
Nowadays, not as much because a lot of other settings have come out for steampunk where it isn't necessarily a Western. It could be a sort of, you know, pseudo-fantasy, pseudo-European, whatever. But I think that a couple of years ago when this idea of steampunk first started coming out, that it wasn't really associated with Westerns. I mean, there was that Will Smith movie, Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
And subsequent, and also the earlier TV show. That was a steampunk movie. And it had a lot of steampunk stuff. Big, giant steam-powered tarantula.
Yeah, I think part of it is because visually speaking, that's where you really start to see that technology in real history. That in real history, I mean, the Western period, I mean, the 1800s, is where suddenly all this steam-powered technology, all the steel and the trains and the, you know, all this kind of stuff starts to really become visible. And I'm guessing that subconsciously is
why
they
called the Civil War the first modern war.
Yeah, I think that's
because of that.
Subconsciously, that is why we kind of morph that, take that to the next logical step and try to imagine their technology doing things their technology should not have been capable of.
Right.
And out of that comes steampunk. Here's a question for running steampunk. How do you put boundaries on the technology? Because coming into this, you have already accepted that the technology is doing things it shouldn't be capable of. You cannot have a steam-powered cyborg. You cannot have a clockwork artificial intelligence.
Why not?
I mean, real life.
I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about
No. I mean,
like, I can cite you several examples.
We've accepted up front. We know that these things are not possible in the real world, but we accept them on a suspension of disbelief in steampunk. Right. But we've talked about in previous episodes, and I don't think this is even the genre series, about how you still have to have clear boundaries to that suspension of disbelief, because otherwise you can't tell a consistent story.
Yeah, and you also have cheesiness, too. You have players who's like, okay, I'm playing a steampunk tinkerer, and I've been playing for a long time. I have all these levels in it and stuff. I make a roll. Okay, you made your roll. What are you trying to build? I'm trying to build the steam-powered atom bomb.
Yeah.
It's like, okay,
so
come on.
How do you set the boundaries on the technology?
One of the important things I think there would be you can't invalidate other classes. Like if you were to try to do this in a D&D type setting or whatever, a fighter needs to be able to fight and to play the game just as effectively as your steampunk whatever, your tinkerer. I think it's important that the technology be on the same power level and also on the same like social level. Just because you're, you know, wearing your steam powered armor, if you go through town and you're just dominating the game, this technology is causing a problem.
Or maybe your group likes that sort of thing. and it works for you.
It just needs to be consistent with the feel of your game.
Yeah. You know, typically I would not recommend using metagame observations as a way of balancing your game in general. But in this case, I got to go with Mike that I think this doesn't necessarily answer the question entirely, but I think would one person with a steam powered whatever dominate the game to the point that the other players would feel worthless? That's a good place to start.
Because to me, that's riffs. It's not just a random blow at riffs.
If you've ever played a mage in riffs alongside a glitter boy, that is exactly how you feel. You are just this worthless tag along. Something else I think you ought to ask yourself is if you're designing the setting, assuming you're not playing a pre-written setting, is what is it that you want the technology to enable?
Yeah.
You know, are you, if you're trying to enable travel, okay, then maybe something like airships is something that you would want in your game, or really fast locomotives.
Mm-hmm. Works great in Final Fantasy.
Works great in Final Fantasy.
I think that one of the things you can do, say you're just building a steampunk game from the ground up, or you're kind of running some homebrew thing and you're like, okay, I want to run steampunk. Sit down with your players and get out a whiteboard or something, or a piece of paper, and start brainstorming and just say, okay, start listing things that are in this world. What are the things you want to see? Clockwork robots, flying airships, steam-powered powered armor. We don't want to see any big steam-powered building-sized transforming robots. That's just too cheesy for us, so that's not in there. And then you go through, and then I think from there you can start saying, well, what can this technology do, and what is it for? And the whole purpose, though, of this entire exercise is that when you run the game, you keep it consistent. I think that's the most important thing in a steampunk game when in regards to the technology, is to just keep it consistent.
I think you can apply that across the board when you get into genres.
Yeah, I think so, too. Like the magic of fantasy and the sci-fi sci-fi, yeah. It's all about keeping it consistent.
What about steampunk running alongside magic? I don't know about it in role-playing games, but like Arcanum, for example, they have the whole balance of technology versus magic thing.
There's a lot of like steampunk genres and stuff where some of them are the sort of sci-fi steampunk, I'll call it, where it is mechanics and physics and the power of steam and invention that drives these technological marvels.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the fantasy steampunk where they don't use coal, they use witch coal, and they burn in infernal engines, and it's the exact same tech as the sci-fi one. It's just the reasons behind it are different.
Right, or you also get like the Arcanum thing where the technology and magic are somehow opposed to one another.
Yeah.
Because this is, once again, where you see the start of the really big industrial stuff, so you suddenly have industrial pushing magic out of the land or whatever.
Yeah, science versus magic kind of deal.
Yeah, one of the things I've noticed about steampunk is it, as a genre, seems so visual.
Yeah,
and
it's all about cool factor, I think.
I think I mentioned this in a previous episode, but somebody posted a link on our forum to a steampunk redo of Star Wars. And at first I was like, okay, this is going to be really dumb. Someone's just taking Star Wars and imprinting another genre on it. Until I actually started looking at the art. I'm like, you know, dumb or not, this actually looks really freaking cool.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something about steampunk. I mean, like, you have that clockwork robot behind you. That's this heaving, smoking, churning,
lumbering thing. And it's not, there's nothing refined. Well, I think you can break steampunk down into like subcategories. I think that when you're dealing with steampunk, it's clunking, it's ratchety, it's belching smoke from its every single crack. There's nothing elegant about it. But I think that you can go into a subgenre of like clockwork steampunk where you can have these robots that do the exact same thing as the big creaking thing. Only it's all refined clockwork gears and cogs and timing and ticking. And then there's a sort of elegance about it. And there's that sort of Victorian appeal to it.
Getting back to a point that Chad made earlier, you were talking about how within steampunk, you always picture it all as being very handmade.
Yeah, I do. I'm sure that
people
can go different directions.
One of the points I had up here was, in addition to what technology, when you're setting the boundaries, you also have to ask yourself how much. Mm-hmm. Because if this technology is readily available as in like there is a huge industry that's churning this stuff out. Think like a Final Fantasy 3/6, depending on which numbering system you prefer, where the technology was everywhere and suddenly the soldiers had these kind of like mechs that they were using and you had castles that could go beneath the surface of the world. And if you, this stuff is everywhere, obviously it's going to have an impact on your society that it's not when there's just a very, very small amount of it. And I guess the point that I would make there is if you're designing a game to think through the impact you want it to have, if you're running a game that's been pre-designed, sit down and look at the kind of technology that's there and intuit out how this has affected the world and how this would figure into daily life.
Right. If how this has changed the world.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, how would an Old West town or a swath of Victorian England be different if that clockwork technology was readily available? It's not just what some crazy professor has, but if you can walk into a bar and your drinks are being served by a clockwork automaton.
That's right up there, though, for me with the dragon bartender in fantasy. I think that you can, it's like anything, you can, there's high fantasy, which has a lot of magic and a lot of this, and then there's low fantasy, which has, you know, a medieval sort of realm that doesn't have necessarily a lot of magic. And I think you can do the same thing with cyberpunk, or I'm sorry, steampunk, is that you can lay on the steampunk stuff really, really thick. I prefer
the subtlety myself.
Yeah. Or you can do the subtlety. Now, see, me, I like super low fantasy, but my steampunk, I like it in the middle. Because I don't want to walk in and it's hard to describe. I don't want it to where there is, this stuff is everywhere, but I do want a lot of it. I don't want it to be the mad professor in the town.
Well, I guess like in a low fantasy, part of, excuse the redundant word here, but part of magic's mystique is the fact that it's implied, but you don't very often see it.
Right.
Whereas we mentioned how steampunk is so visual. If you never see it, Who cares anymore?
Yeah.
Some professor somewhere might be able to put together a steam-powered robot.
Yeah.
Who gives a crap?
Yeah, basically that's a Western with an anachronism. Yeah. That's not steampunk.
Well, the witch might put a hex on me, has an emotional power to it.
But there's other shades of gray, too. I mean, you could walk into a town wearing, I realize I keep using this example of steam-powered armor. But if you walk into this town wearing steam-powered armor, you know, there could be this thing of, oh my God, what is that? Which is kind of the level you're talking about. Or this could be more of along the lines of thing of, oh, I've heard of this stuff, but I've never seen anything.
Well, right. And I'm not suggesting a level that's best. I mean, I'm not saying that it's got to be a medium, high, or low. I mean, it's whatever's appropriate to the game. I'm just making the point that because steampunk carries so much of its power from its visual appeal, that if it's completely invisible to your game, it's not like magic. It can't have an undercurrent power.
Yeah.
If it's completely invisible, it's worthless to the game. I mean,
nobody cares.
Yeah.
Because I think that steampunk is all about style. It's that sort of Gilded Age style where somebody posted a link on our forums one time about the steampunk keyboard. All it was a keyboard, wasn't really powered by steam, had the same functions as a normal plastic keyboard, only it was made out of brass and mahogany and had felt buttons and it looked like
a typewriter.
It looked like if a Gilded Age Victorian were to design a keyboard, this is what he would design.
And what did it plug into, or did you just type on it for
no
reason?
No, it was a fully working keyboard.
Like for your computer.
For your computer.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty cool. So
check out our forums and find it.
I think that's about going to do it for steampunk.
Hey, did we ever mention Worldwide Wing Night?
No, we'll do that as a quick closing announcement before we wrap out. Once again, we are going to have the second Worldwide Wing Night. And Adam, what is the date on this? It is
May 18th, isn't it?
I believe it's May 18th.
Oh, good save, Mike.
Which is a Friday. Yes. And if you are in St. Louis, be sure to stop by our forums and get in touch with us because we will be having it at a
that one place in Fenton.
Yeah, place in Fenton called That One Place at, I believe, 7 o'clock.
Yes, I definitely know it is at 7.
So. And I will have you know that Tony of Fanboy Smackdown Radio has picked up
Smackdown Radio.
Oh, I keep saying it wrong. Shows you how much I listen to it, although it is a really good cast. But he has indeed picked up the gauntlet and accepted the Watchmen Challenge.
So there, in addition to wing consumption and beer consumption,
there will be a showdown.
There will be a showdown over Watchmen.
There will be large two large, burly, drunken men yelling nonsense at each other about nonsense, exactly.
All right, so thank you guys for tuning in. We will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.